I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, how the myth of Texas shapes real life here. We'll spend this hour with Lawrence Wright. He's on staff at The New Yorker, but was raised in Dallas and now lives in Austin. Wright's newest book contemplates the things that give the state an outsized influence on America. We'll talk about the difference between AM radio Texans and FM radio Texans, and about how we became such a red state, and whether that will last as our cities keep getting bluer. We'll also talk about why it's so hard to describe Texas culture. Our conversation starts after a short break. In my 34 years living in Texas, I've visited every big city and a lot of the small towns. I felt welcome here from the day I arrived, but I haven't necessarily felt like I belonged. I don't ride horses, I don't have ties to the oil and gas industry, and I don't think I have an identifiable accent. But Lawrence Wright's new book has me reconsidering my Texas identity, and yours as well. We Texans have been inventing and pushing back on our own mythology for nearly 200 years. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Wright is an ideal guide to the ways we've responded to the image Texas holds in the popular imagination. He's on staff at The New Yorker, was raised mostly in Dallas, and has lived in New Orleans, Atlanta, and Cairo. He lives now in Austin. His new book is called God Save Texas, A Journey into the Soul of the Lone Star State. He joins us from the studios of KUT in Austin to talk about it. Larry, welcome back to Think.
Thanks, Chris. It's good to talk to you again.
So there's the image the rest of the country has of Texas. There's the image we have of ourselves. What are the biggest differences?
Well, you know, I think that the country at large, even for people who've never been to Texas, maybe especially for those people, Texas is considered rather rural, regressive, and the proponent of all things heartless where social policies are concerned. I think there's still an image in the rest of the world of Texas as being this kind of cowboy state. And, it does not take into account the fact that Texas is very urbane. The cities are extremely progressive. And, it's as liberal an entity inside the cities as most cities in America. So, there are two very different conceptions of the state. Both of them are true. Texas does have a very conservative side to it. The myth of the cowboy and the oil man and all of that is still very much a big part of the way Texans identify themselves.
How did we become such a Republican stronghold in the first place?
Well, it's interesting because when I was a young man living in Dallas, Texas was blue. And California was red. These two entities we think of being as polar opposites, and I think of them as being like strands of DNA that revolve around each other but don't actually touch. They just continually oppose each other. And, Texas and California are sort of the poles upon which our whole body politic revolves. I was talking to Karl Rove about this, who had done so much to change Texas from blue to red. And he attributes it in part to immigration. In the 60s, for instance, when our own family moved from Oklahoma first to Abilene and then to Dallas, my father was an Eisenhower Republican, like quite a lot of immigrants who were coming into Texas at that time. And so he came from a different voting history. And Dallas was one of the boom towns of that era. And, to some large extent, the immigration shifted. It was already a conservative town, but they were conservatives who were used to voting for Democrats. And then it became a Republican town with the election of Bruce Alger, the first Republican congressman elected from Texas. And that's when it really began.
We traded away our status as an independent nation so we could preserve slavery. That is a fact, but it's not one that gets a lot of attention in the seventh grade Texas history textbooks.
No, it's interesting to think that, you know, Texas was founded as a slave colony. And Stephen F. Austin was dismayed by that, but he still went ahead and allowed the importation of slaves. Although they weren't called slaves when they entered Texas, they were required to sign a document that said that they were indentured servants. There was a small, they weren't actually paid anything.
Indentured they servants remained, for life is what
yeah,
they were.
They were still slaves, but it was a kind of political dodge to allow, you know, in a Mexican colony, allow slaves to be there. And then when there were two offers, one was, you know, to remain in Mexico, but if you did that, Mexico had liberated slaves, and the colony of Texas refused to do that. And then Great Britain offered the Republic of Texas the opportunity to have a massive bailout. And but the only condition was that they pay wages for all labor. And the young republic decided not to do that and instead entered the Union as a slave state.
Hmm. Wendy Davis insists we're not a red state now, that we're a non-voting blue state.
Well, she's very correct in that observation, in that the population of Texas is far more progressive than its elected representatives would allow you to believe. And, you know, I've talked to people about, you know, the demography of the state and why it's not accurately represented in our politics. And part of it certainly is the fact that, you know, gerrymandering has carved up districts very ingeniously. For instance, I live in Austin, which had a historic Democratic congressional seat that even Lyndon Johnson once occupied. Now it's been carved into six districts with five Republicans and one Democrat. My representative is a car dealer in Weatherford, 200 miles north of us. And there's another factor, you know, that is the fact that, you know, often stated that Hispanics don't vote. Well, it's true. I asked Garnet Coleman, a black representative from Houston, about why it is that Hispanic voter participation in California is so much higher. And although we both have about 40% Hispanic population, and we're both majority minority states. And he said that he thought it was the Cesar Chavez organizing the grape pickers union. He said, when you go into a union, you become political. But I don't think that is an entirely satisfactory solution. If you just take the ethnic question out of it and look at who doesn't vote, for the most part, the non-voters are young, poor, and unemployed. And it happens that you know, Texas has a lot of people in that category.
You say that we have nurtured an immature political culture that's done damage to the state and also to the country as a whole. So what kind of bad habits have we exported from Texas?
Well, I just mentioned redistricting, you know, with the gerrymandering that was so evident in Austin when the Republicans finally took over the Texas House in 2003. They began, you know, one of the objects of taking over the Texas House was simply to gain control of the redistricting process. And it was Tom Craddock, who then became the Speaker of the Texas House, and Tom DeLay, who was then the majority leader in the U.S. House, who crafted the redistricting in Texas that shifted the congressional delegation to a heavily Republican delegation that was almost invulnerable to change. And other states began to come to Texas, according to Craddock, and study the model that they created. And I think that that has had a pernicious effect on our politics, where it's very, very difficult to vote out incumbents now. And districts are safe seats, and people who are occupying those seats don't have quite the need, as they did in the past, to balance the demands of their constituents.
Where does Barbara Bush fit into the mythology of what it means to be a Texan?
You know, I think the Bush family, I was saddened to hear about her death. When I was working on my book, I went out to Odessa and Midland, and it occurred to me, you know, that the Bushes, like a lot of people, you know, came to Texas during that time to try to strike it rich. And of course, George H.W. Bush was already from a wealthy family in Connecticut. His father was about to become a U.S. senator. But he brought his bride to Odessa, which was, you know, very, still remote, but it was really out there. They lived in a duplex with a pair of prostitutes, a mother and daughter pair. And so
they shared a bathroom with them, right?
Yeah, they often got locked out by thoughtless clients. and you think about how humble that, and you know, Odessa was really a rough and tumble town. And then they, you know, moved on up the ladder to Midland, and I went over there. Their house there is preserved. And it's nothing fancy. It reminds me of a lake cabin, and you know there are three bedrooms, and one of them had the door taken off, and that was the bedroom for their daughter Robin, who died of leukemia, and the door was off so they could attend her whenever they heard her cry out. And it was during that period of time when Barbara Bush was in her 20s that her hair turned white, and she dyed it for a while and then gave up on that. But you can imagine the kind of sadness and grief and stress that she underwent during that period of time. It was very visible to me in that absent door.
Another myth of Texas, right, Larry, is that the state was built by people who got rich because they were lucky. You know, they were wildcatters who struck oil rather than because of any particular genius or work ethic. It seems like a strange myth for any Texan to buy into, and yet there's a little bit of that persists in the idea we have of ourselves.
Yeah, I think, you know, Texas, until really the modern era, the route to wealth in Texas was through oil, through cattle, or timber. And you know, you don't need to be highly educated in those pursuits, or at least not at that time. And so education, I don't think, was as highly valued or as absolutely necessary as it is, has become now. But, you know, there's something that you mentioned, the element of luck. There is a kind of weird luck attached to. When I was studying oil, for instance, Spindletop, you know, which mm-hmm. is really what brought Texas into the 20th century, 1901, when it was struck. And this con man named Patillo Higgins, who had lost an arm in a gunfight with a deputy sheriff, there was a hill outside Beaumont called Sour Spring Mound, and it was so gassy that school kids would sometimes set it on fire. And he forecast that it would bring, you know, he would strike oil at 1,000 feet, and he'd made that figure up. But he very authoritative and went around raising money to drill, and 1,046 feet he struck oil. And it was the first gusher. He had determined that he was going to get a well that would produce 50 barrels a day. But suddenly, when this eruption came from the center of the earth, it just, you know, throwing 6 tons of drilling pipe through the rig, and then followed by mud and boulders, and then this spewing 100,000 gallons of oil a day into the air. Nobody had ever seen anything like that. And it was more than all the wells in America combined at the time. And similarly, when the Daisy Bradford number 3 well came in East Texas 30 years later, it was another con man, a guy named Dad Joyner, who was projecting that he would tap into the deepest, the greatest oil field in America at 3,500 feet, and he produced phony geological reports. There was nothing to support his assertion, but right about at 3,500 feet, he tapped into the greatest oil field that America had ever seen. So, you know, with those kinds of strokes of luck, I think that luck will always play a part in the Texas mythology.
Lawrence Wright is my guest. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker based in Austin. His new book is called God Save Texas, A Journey into the Soul of the Lone Star State. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or go to Twitter. We're at @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is New Yorker staff writer Lawrence Wright, who is based in Austin and has a new book out called God Save Texas, A Journey into the Soul of the Lone Star State. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Okay, Larry, what is the difference between FM Texas and AM Texas?
Well, I was driving all around Texas, and I realized that you can be in two states in the same time, depending on what band on the radio dial you're listening to. And if you are on the AM dial, you have the right-wing politics, the Rush Limbaughs or, Alex Jones, Laura Ingraham, the evangelical sermons, and all of the things that people outside of the state associate with the kinds of, Texas thinking, Texas culture. But if you turn on FM Texas, you're in the kingdom of NPR, and it's urbane, it's cosmopolitan, and it's not unlike the kind of FM station that you would have anywhere else in the country. And it goes to the difference between Texas city culture and Texas suburban and rural culture, which is quite marked, I think, and it's one of the fundamental divides in our state right now.
You say the AM political agenda is the agenda for Texas politics these days.
Well, best expression of that is our lieutenant governor, Dan Patrick, mm-hmm. who was is still an AM radio shock jock. And he had espoused the furthest reach of the Tea Party social agenda, the bathroom bill and the sanctuary cities bill and his attacks on public education. All of those things are a part of the extreme social agenda that the Tea Party in Texas is now propagating. And Dan Patrick is, the voice of it in a literal sense on the radio.
You say that FM and AM Texans rarely talk, although I have to say, I know a lot of people who have family members on the other side of band.
Yeah. There was an incident here in the studio where I'm talking, where Dan Patrick came on the Texas Standard Show to talk with David Brown. And David asked him a question about whether it was, Patrick is a big supporter of the police, and David asked him about police shootings, and Patrick said, yeah, that question is exactly why I don't go on NPR, and he got up and left the studio. So I think there was an instance where AM and FM met, and it didn't end well.
But there are times when we surprise ourselves on both sides. Talk a little bit about Joseph Weidnecht and Amina Abdin.
Oh, that was such a touching thing. There was a demonstration. We had to do in Austin near the Capitol about the Trump administration's crackdown on immigrants, and there were a lot of people marching in the street, and there were counter demonstrators. Joseph Weidnecht was one of them, who were Trump supporters, and he had a Make America Great Again shirt on. And he's a welder. He's a massive man, but he was surrounded by these some of them in those those anonymous masks.
The Guy Fawkes masks.
Yes, yeah. Thank you, Chris. Mm-hmm. And they had cigarette lighters, and they were threatening to set him on fire. Mm-hmm. And this young Muslim woman, I think she was 19, and petite, and she stood in front of this mountainous man and protected him. And she said later, "I don't stand for what he stands for," but she was an immigrant from a Muslim country, and she valued the freedom to speak more than some of those protesters did.
You note that you could never have lasted in Texas if it were exactly the same place you grew up in, and that for a time you became a self-hating Texan.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I grew up in Dallas, Abilene first and then Dallas, and I was in Dallas when Kennedy was killed. And I remember that era with a lot of sadness. Dallas was in a very, very difficult place in its history. It was, there were a lot of really wild right-wing fanatics who were in control of the city's politics and the political culture. And you may not remember, but there was, when Adlai Stevenson came to town, he was the ambassador to the United Nations. Some woman, a wife of a prominent insurance executive, hit him over the head with a placard. The sign said, "If you seek peace, ask Jesus." And then, of course, Kennedy came and was killed. And of course, Dallas was taken down. And Dallas, despite the fact that the right-wing political culture had nothing to do with Kennedy's death, it was a Marxist. We didn't even know we had one. But the humiliation that the city endured, I think, really marked me as well as probably everyone in the city at the time. And so there was a great stigma for being from Dallas in particular, but Texas in general. And I also felt that the culture I was living in didn't represent who I felt I was or wanted to be. So I was propelled out of the city, and I wanted to go to the city least like Dallas I could find. So I went to New Orleans and went to Tulane for university. And I thought I would never come back to Texas because it just didn't strike me as being the kind of place that would welcome the person that I was. But, years later, I was working for Look magazine, and there was a story they had me do about the 12 men that walked on the moon. So one of them, Charlie Duke, was then walking on New Braunfels. So I flew into Austin and drove down to New Braunfels, and they put me up in a little bed and breakfast that had a Rathskeller in the basement. And I thought, I'll have a brat and a brew, and I'll walk around the town and read a book, and that'll be Saturday night in New Braunfels. So that's where my expectations were. And I went down to the Rathskeller, and there was Frank Bailey, who was the Texas Monthly restaurant critic, and he totally took control of my evening. We went out to eat in a roadhouse where you order steak by the inch, and Frank got a 3-inch steak.
3 inches rare. Thick. Is that what you mean?
3 inches thick.
Wow.
Yes, it was bleeding all over the plate. I could scarcely look at it. And then we went around to different dance halls and wound up in Green, Texas' oldest dance hall. And Asleep at the Wheel was playing. A young man named George Strait had opened for them. And it just felt, familiar. The songs, the accents, the food, the long necks in the hip pockets, the aerodynamic skirts, all of this seemed mysteriously and suspiciously curated to awaken the homesickness that I had been suppressing for such a long time. And as it happened, a month after my article came out, I got a call from Bill Broyles, who was then the editor of Texas Monthly. And by the end of the conversation, I was moving home.
My guest is Lawrence Wright. If you'd like to join the conversation about his book, God Save Texas, A Journey into the Soul of the Lone Star State, you can call 800-933-5372. Let's speak with Anne in Wimberley. Hi, Anne.
Hi. Good to talk to you and love your work, Lawrence. My first husband and I graduated from the University of Texas, and he went to graduate school at London School of Economics. And when he arrived at class, they were hoping to see a cowboy economist. Instead, my husband had on his Harris tweed jacket and loafers. And I think it was a mark against him his entire year in grad school because he didn't look like a cowboy. And this mythology that everyone from Texas rides horses, wears cowboy hats and cowboy boots seemed to perpetuate everywhere we went in London and in other places in Europe.
Thanks for your call. Talk a little bit, Larry, about why you think the stereotype has persisted when there have always been a variety of people living in this state.
Yeah, it's a good point, Chris. And I think partly people cherish the idea of Texas. And when Ann was talking, I was remembering that when I was a young man teaching at the American University in Cairo, I used to sometimes go out to the pyramids where there was a stable, and I go riding in the desert. And I'm a Dallas boy. I'm not a cowboy by any means. But they found out I was from Texas, and they used to call me Texas. And one day I went out there, and they said, "Oh, Texas, we've got a horse for you." And two men bring this thing, this rearing stallion who's pawing the air, and his nostrils are flaring. And it's just scary as it can be. And yet, in order to uphold my state's reputation, I had to get on top of that steed, and he took me halfway to Libya before I was able to turn him around. And I felt that was really astride the Texas myth. It was intriguing to me that people, there was a lot of prejudice against Texas, and some of it's deserved. But there is also something fond about the idea of the independence and the adventurousness and the boldness that the Texas spirit embodies and is so revealed by the cowboy mythology.
Yeah, is that real Texas or is that Hollywood Texas?
Well, I think Hollywood, Texas, has always played a part in the way people understand our state. When I was young, those Hollywood, Texas movies were all filmed in Arizona parkland, which stood in for this kind of existential tablet that Texas was supposed to be. And, John Wayne was the exemplar of the Texas masculine hero. And that persisted up until the Kennedy assassination, at which time everything Texas in Hollywood was pernicious. They were chainsaw massacrers, and there were, the Dr. Strangelove characters. Everything about Texas was deplored. And it wasn't until Texans began making their own movies, especially when the Larry McMurtry novels like HUD and All My Friends Are Going to Be Strangers and things like that. The Last Picture Show in particular. Those pictures were actually made in Texas, and they reflected the Texas that we truly lived in. It's the first time I had a sense of recognition in a movie theater about Texas and what it was. Now that Texans are making more of their own movies, we have a chance to take control of our own story.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Yeah, that is what you call level 3 Texas. So let's start out with level 1 Texas and level 2 Texas. What do you mean by these levels of Texas?
Well, my analysis of culture is, especially as it pertains to Texas, is that there are three levels. And the bottom is the primitive level, which is really the stuff that has always marked Texas and set it apart. Just the kinds you think of like barbecue and boots and cowboy hats and big belt buckles and the way we speak, the twang, and all of those things are recognizably Texas artifacts. They're valuable because they're very much things that set Texas apart from being another kind of place. And I was born into that level one culture in Texas, but most of my life has been lived in the arrival of level two, which is when money comes into the state and people begin to raise their heads over the fence and look at what other cultures are doing, and it's a stage of insecurity and neurosis, but also of acquisition and education. It's during that period of time that the museums and the dance companies are created, the theaters. It's when children go off to school and Eastern schools, or everybody goes traveling to Europe, and you spend your time learning about what other cultures do and how they live their lives, and then returning to your state and imitating those things. And, you see level two culture all over the state, particularly, for instance, in the way our cities look. They look like cities in any other state. There's a high level of sameness, what Ross Perot used to call world class. That was one of his phrases when he was running for president. And it's exactly what Texans wanted out of level two. But as I said, it's imitative and neurotic. And there is a third stage when you've gone through and found what level two has to offer you. And then you go back to your roots and look at what makes your state or your culture so distinct in the first place. And you look at it again with a sense of forgiveness and understanding. And it's once you do that, you have the opportunity, like Alvin Ailey, who came from this little fly speck town called Ranger, Texas, in creating his famous dance Revelation, about the Baptist church he grew up in, or Beyonce, looking back at her church music and the country music in Houston, Larry McMurtry, and all the great writers and artists that we produced, they have gone through that process of educating themselves and then returning to look at their roots and finding something distinctive about who we are.
So if you were to overlay level three onto like Maslow's hierarchy of need, level three is self-actualization.
It's an excellent way of understanding it, Chris, because in that middle area, when you're in level two, you're always trying to be someone else. And you can never be as good as the culture that you're envying, because that is it's more native to them than it is to us.
Level two made me think about Eve biting the apple, right? Before she gets punished by God, but after she realizes she's naked and she's really insecure.
Yeah. Well, the neurosis that has always been a part of the Texas that I knew is really a reflection of that. And, I think what has been a pleasure to me in growing older in this state is seeing how there's been a reconciliation of Texans with the country, the culture that they actually live in. And I think it's become a very prosperous time artistically for the state.
My guest is author Lawrence Wright. His new book is called God Save Texas, A Journey into the Soul of the Lone Star State. We will take more of your calls after the break. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org or leave a message on Twitter. We're @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with writer Lawrence Wright. His new book is called God Save Texas, A Journey into the Soul of the Lone Star State. You can join us from anywhere in the state or anywhere else at 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Houston now and speak with Riyad. Hi, Riyad.
Hello there. I just want to share a couple of anecdotes, as your host has told me. I just celebrated yesterday proudly being a Texan for the past 50 years.
All right.
I grew up in Fort Worth and Dallas, and she wanted me to share a couple of the anecdotes. Well, I grew up, I came from the Middle East, and you can relate, Lawrence can relate to having lived in Egypt. I learned British English, and I come to Fort Worth, Texas, and I found out they're speaking Texan English. And I could not understand them, nor they could understand me. And one story is, I go in the bus every morning to go to school, and the old man driver was sitting there. I said, good morning, and he said something to me I could not understand, nor I could remember. I waited for 3 months, trying to remember, then I remembered. I would say good morning, go, howdy doody. I said, wait a minute, howdy doody is not part of the English language. So I just wanted to share those kind of anecdotal stories. And I'm proud to be a Texan. Yesterday I had a big celebration with a proclamation for the city of being 50 years Texan.
Well, we're glad to have you, Riyadh. Thanks for calling.
Mabruk.
Have you, do you feel like everybody has a moment where they have to come to terms with their Texas identity if they weren't born here?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, but I think that's true of every Texan, whether they're born here or not. You know, the first time you go outside the state, you have to cope with, the projections that people have about Texas. And I think to some extent it breaks down on political lines. Liberals tend to dread Texas. They see it as predatory and heartless, and conservatives tend to think of it as a kind of homeland of individualism and entrepreneurialism. And both things are true. You know, Texas lives in a state, a dynamic state of tension between these different impulses. But people look at Texas with, very, very, even there's a phrase in Norwegian, I might screw it up, but Darvel helt Texas, which means it was totally bonkers. And I have a Norwegian friend who tells me that it's actually said with a touch of admiration, which I'll take his word for.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372. Gary's on the line in San Antonio. Hi, Gary.
Hey, how are you, Chris?
Very well, thanks.
I just wanted to say, I grew up in Pearsall, Texas, which is where George Strait grew up, and his daddy was our school teacher in junior high. And President Johnson taught there for about a year. I think it was back in the 60s. But long story short, both George and I have exhibits at the New Whitty Museum in San Antonio. Mine is on the Lower Pecos rock art, which I discovered there was a piece of rock art out there that's a 2,000-year-old map of Texas. And it's just kind of funny how we both grew up in the same town, wound up in the same museum. Having grown up in that environment, in Texas and Pearsall, it was a different place back in the 60s and 70s. Moms and dads communicated. Both sides of the tracks were always talking with each other. And just wanted to make that point, that there is something mysterious about the state. The way that I grew up, anyway.
Thanks for your call, Gary. What do you think about that, Larry?
I think it's interesting that, there's so much diversity in the state. And, it's my friend Stephen Harrigan, the novelist and essayist, says, Texas is where everything comes to an end. The South ends in East Texas, the Great Plains ends in North Texas, the Mountain West ends in West Texas, and Mexico ends in South Texas, and it all sort of peters out here. But there's something that holds us together as a community, and I'm a little puzzled about it. Texas is a huge place. It's bigger than France, so it could be its own country, and everybody in Texas knows that we have the right to divide ourselves into five different states if we choose to, with 10 senators. Think how dominant these five entities would be in our national politics. But we've chosen never to do that. There's some unifying force that I think of as a sense of community that the caller was expressing that has the state cohere. I remember when I first came to work for Texas Monthly, it was one of the very first regional magazines, and Bill Broyles decided to export the idea to California. And so he left Texas Monthly to go start this other California magazine. It just didn't work because Californians are so divided north and south that they don't feel the same sense of community that Texans do.
You and Stephen Harrigan have done a lot of cross-country cycling around the state. What can you learn about Texas traveling on a bike that you miss in a car or a pickup?
Well, there are, I think of there being different kinds of landscapes, and some, you know, you dawdle walking through and appreciating, you know, every little flower, and some are wonderful for bicycling through or horseback riding through, and there's some places that should be driven through pretty rapidly, and then there's some places that ought to be just flown over, and a lot of Texas I put in that category, but I am especially fond of the hill country. And, you know, this time of year, too, I know that blue bonnets are corny and so on, but I just love seeing the roadside so carpeted. And my father was at one point the head of Beautify Texas, and he was responsible for buying a lot of the seeds that were sprayed along the roadsides. And after he passed away, I found a letter in his files from Lady Bird Johnson thanking him for the seeds that were, for the wildflowers that were placed around Lady Bird, what's now called Lady Bird Lake, Town Lake. And I had run around that lake 1,000 times and never realized, you know, that my father's own contribution to that. But it's, you know, the attention to the beauty that we have. We're not honestly blessed with great beauty as a state, but we, you know, I think that it allows us to cherish what we have in a way that maybe some other people don't have that opportunity.
It feels like bluebonnet pictures are maybe one of those things that families have in common regardless of where they lie on the political spectrum.
Well, it's part of that, you know, level one Texas.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's one reason I think those bluebonnet pictures were so disdained during the level two period, is they're corny. But they're so evocative of Texas and what people love about it.
All right, back to the phones, 1-800-933-5372. Pauline is on the line in San Antonio. Hey, Pauline.
Hello. My sort of question slash rant is, how do you stop perpetuating the stereotype of Texas? I mean, I have family outside the state. I've been outside of the U.S., and I have people ask me if I ride horses to school and ask me to speak in a Texan accent, which I do not, and I do not like speaking like that. So how do you stop the perpetuation of it?
Pauline, you buy my book and send it to them. It will all be explained. It reminds me of my friend Steve Harrigan, who I've already mentioned. He took horseback riding in college for physical education requirement and got an F. And the last time he was on a horse was to pose for a photograph for Texas Monthly and fell off and broke his arm. So, and I don't think he's ever, you know, he said he hadn't had a pair of boots since he was 5 years old, and I've never even seen him in jeans. So I think it's possible to be a fully functioning Texan without any of the appurtenances that people associate with it. It's just that people have to get more familiar with the diversity of opinion and population that we have in this state.
Well, you write that you don't think there's any man your age from Texas who hasn't at some point felt the sting of not really fulfilling that stereotype that people have.
Well, it is, you know, it's a kind of glorious thing to have this image of, you know, it's a powerful image of individualism, of power, of, you know, of assertiveness, of being able to act in the world, you know, that, you know, that is such a feature of the Texas mythology. And there are oftentimes, you know, we live in, you know, a compromised bureaucratic culture where those kinds of traits are not so easily expressed. And I think that there's a tension between being a Texan in the modern urban corporate world and being in the shadow, let's say, of that enormous myth that hangs over us, the big Tex that is always in the back of our minds.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You also mentioned, Larry, that if you're going to tell people from many other parts of the country that you're from Texas, there's one reaction depending on who you're talking to. But then when you say you're from Austin, people are like, oh, well, Austin's okay. First of all, something I learned from the book that I had no idea was that Austin is the number two tourist destination in America behind Las Vegas now?
Yeah, what's up with that? I don't know.
I mean, I love Austin, but that surprised me.
Well, all of these accolades come in, and, you know, like Forbes, is second year in a row, said that we're the best city in America to live in. And so, yeah, I love living in Austin, and it's hard for me to draw those comparisons. You know, Austin, when I would say to people I'm from Texas, and I would get that, you know, stern look that so often you run into, censorious. And then you wear in Texas, Austin. Oh, Austin's cool. That has been going on ever since I moved here. I moved here in 1980. And yet Austin wasn't really cool in 1980. I would say it was slack. It was the main thing that you got. It was a very casual, relaxed, dopey place. And yet it had this reputation that just gained more and more momentum. And what has been interesting to me is to watch in the time that I've lived here how the city has changed, in large part because of the vision of unique individuals who had a drive, like Michael Dell, as a freshman pre-med in UT, started assembling computers in his dorm room. And the whole tech industry that is now the fundamental part of Texas, of Austin's economy, started in that dorm room with Michael Dell. And John Mackey, who started America's first organic foods grocery store, which is about the size of a 7-Eleven. And it got flooded out during the Memorial Day flood in 1981. And his customers and vendors helped him restock the shelves. And a few years later, it's a Fortune 500 company called Whole Foods. And Whole Foods, along with Central Market, you know, we have the best groceries in the entire world, I'm sure. And Mike Levy starting Texas Monthly, attracting writers like me from all over the country, and Bill Witliff deciding not to move to Hollywood after doing Lonesome Dove, and Rick Linklater and Robert Rodriguez and other filmmakers are still here because of that. In all of these instances, music is more diverse and complicated, but once again, you know, people like Clifford Antone, creating a center around which a culture grows. And as it happens, people move here because of that, and reinforces the image of the city. And Austin becomes more and more like its reputation. And one thing that is characteristic of all the new migrants is as soon as they get here, they become nostalgic for the way the city used to be.
Right. Do you think that Austin is in danger of being a victim of its own success?
Well, victim is maybe not the right word to use. Austin is destined to be a great city, and great in many different respects. It is, you know, the 11th largest city in America now. It's hard to imagine. But, it's been growing at a frantic rate, and it's like almost all the cities in Texas, we're having a hard time keeping up with the influx of new migrants. But yes, there's a loss. And I remember I used to be, whenever I got on a plane, it seemed like I knew somebody. And now, that rarely ever happens. There's a sense of we're living now in a big city. When I moved here in 1980, there were still unpaved streets downtown. Hmm. I do miss that. But on the other hand, there's a electricity and a dynamism in the city now that wasn't there then. And I honestly count that true of many of our major cities in the state. I think, I've spent time in Dallas and Houston a considerable amount recently. And to me, I think all of the cities have a sense of life in them that is not, it's not new exactly, but it's more reinforced. They're more vigorous and interesting than they ever have been.
Lawrence Wright is a staff writer for The New Yorker, but he lives in Austin. His new book is called God Save Texas, A Journey into the Soul of the Lone Star State. Larry, it's always great to have you. Thank you very much for making this time for us.
My pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. You can find the podcast using any podcast app or go straight to our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.